Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Adulski. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl, and we have somebody who we've been wanting to get on for a while.
We're very excited.
Dr. Jen Gunter, OBGYN, but very into menopause and dispelling myths about menopause all online. You got two books now, right? Or is a third coming out? You have like 10 books? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I actually have four books.
Four books?
Yeah, I know, right? But one is on prematurity. And that's kind of how I got into, you know, debunking health information online. And that was kind of my entry into, you know, how it's so easy for people to get pushed down rabbit holes or fall down rabbit holes.
Yeah.
But three books on women's health. Yeah. The Vagina Bible, the Menopause Manifesto, and Blood, which is all about menstruation.
Perfect. You're the perfect. Yeah. And I've been following you for a while. I appreciate your vulgar content. I always appreciate that.
I think most people appreciate it on this podcast. We've had a few comments that they don't, but I think most people do because it's supposed to be fun and silly. And so lay it out there.
We don't have to try to be vulgar, but if it comes out, that's fine.
Usually so, I get fired every time from this podcast, and maybe by this time next week we can
Yeah, I can't get fired. So just for anybody listening, I recently left Weight Watchers. I'm a free agent at this moment. So yeah, I can't get fired, but I still might get fired though.
And the news with me is that I guess I just say exactly what's going on. My hospital system that we tried to develop, well, we did develop the endocrinology department for them over the past couple of years. Leadership has changed and I don't know if we don't make enough money or we spend too much money or something, but we are getting the kibosh in 6 months. And so I have some ideas that we will share at some point, I'm sure.
I'm pretty sure it's because my brother eats all the food from all the drug reps and doesn't actually practice medicine. So we want to get into we haven't talked much about menopause in this podcast. We were waiting. I was actually waiting for Dr. Gunter to come on because I think she just does the best job online doing it. I've seen so many charlatans just pushing nonsense out there. And I wanted to get someone who's like knows it very well and won't, you know, spread BS. Let's just get into it.
She doesn't believe us, but we're very serious.
Yeah, no, we're very serious. We were waiting for you. I do it in primary care. My brother does an endocrinologist, but it's like, we want Jen to do it. Dr. Gunter. So.
Well, thanks for waiting. Yeah, I had a bit of a bad 3 months with, you know, my son had his pulmonary valve replaced and then had a lot of complications, unfortunately, afterwards. So it's kind of been the summer of the heart, in fact, in my house. But now we're all beyond that. And so now I'm able to kind of reengage with life a little bit more.
Well, thanks for making the time. What are like the basic things you start off when you're like teaching people online, teaching patients about like menopause, like what the heck is it? Like what is it? I'd love to just get into that.
Yeah. So menopause is the planned end of ovarian function. So what's really fascinating about human biology and actually killer whale biology too, but you know, we'll just talk about the humans, is that almost all mammals die after they finish reproducing, right? You know, dogs can have puppies right up until, you know, basically a few months before they would die from old age. So many, many mammals are like this. And humans and killer whales have very long post-reproductive life periods. In fact, you know, easily a third or sometimes a half of your life. And so menopause is that post phase where your reproductive function has ended. Your ovulation has ended, but you are still, you know, living a very productive, healthy, you know, life. And so it's not a sign of, you know, it's an expiration date or anything like that. And unfortunately, there's a lot of misconceptions about about it related primarily to a book from 1966 called Feminine Forever, which was written, which was funded by the people who made Premarin at the time, but people didn't know that. And of course, this is where this idea that all women were meant to sort of drop dead before menopause kind of came about. And, you know, this idea, this false idea that if vaccines and good nutrition are allowing women to live into their 50s and beyond. And it's like, really? Well, no one ever says that vaccines and good nutrition are allowing men to live into their 50s and beyond. Like why all women would drop dead at 50? So, you know, this, we first of all have to get beyond that misconception.
Yeah. What, and look, to get technical, what, how do you know when you're in menopause? Like, how do you know when is it over?
Yeah. So we divide menopause into a couple of different phases. So the menopause transition, which is the time leading up to menopause. Menopause medically is your last menstrual period, and everything after is postmenopause. But that's kind of kludgy and doesn't really work for how we're talking about it. So I tell people to not fixate too much on that and kind of think about more like the menopause transition, which is the time leading up to it, and menopause, which would be your last period and everything after. Now, we can't say that you're in menopause till you haven't had a period for a year, because we don't know it's your last period until it's your last period. And so that's where a lot of confusion comes into play. Now, what's important for people to understand is it doesn't really matter. You know, if you're still having two periods a year, or you're a year beyond your last period, we're almost always going to treat every single thing the same. The only difference is maybe assessing your risk for endometrial cancer. And obviously studies, it's important. But for the average person, it doesn't really matter. And so to try not to get too hung up on it, what's really important is, are the symptoms, are the health conditions that you're experiencing, could they be related to the menopause transition or menopause?
And what's the medical definition of period, or the transition period? How do you
So it's kind of a slow slide, if you will. And it's hard to sort of say this is the start, in the same way it's hard to say, like, what's the first day you started puberty, right? Like, you don't really know until you look backwards and you're like, oh, I was growing, I got some acne, right? So the menopause transition, we define it as once you start going more than 7 days between the start of your period. So normally there's a variation up to 7 days, you know, cycle to cycle. So you could have a 26-day cycle and a 30-day cycle, and that would be normal. And in the early menopause transition, people will start having cycles more than 7 days, sort of difference in length. And in the late menopause transition, people will have cycles that are up to 60 days and sort of in length. So meaning you're skipping periods. And once you're reliably skipping periods, you're probably anywhere between 1 to 3 years away from your final period.
Got it. And you say you treat them similarly.
Yeah.
This is important
when we get into how we sort of get patients presenting to us differently that I want to talk about later, because I get a lot of that. I get a lot of patients in that transitional time period. Personally.
Yeah. And it's marked. So, you know, almost everybody has irregular menstrual cycles. And that, so obviously those people are going to come probably to the gynecologist, right? You've got irregular periods. There's something I need to know about. Is this a problem? And for, you know, for us, we have to say, okay, is this a regular period due to menopause, or is it due to something else? Because there's other causes too. So if you're over 45, and you're skipping periods, like, we don't need to do any other tests. Like, you're in the menopause transition, or you're in menopause. That's the time when it's expected to happen. So in the same way, if someone came into your office, like in primary care, and they're 13 and they got their period, you wouldn't say, wow, we need to investigate this cause of vaginal bleeding. You'd say, yeah, we expect a period to start. But just like if you were 35 and your periods stop, or you're 2 and your periods start, that's like out of the spec of normal. And that's when an investigation would be needed.
Yeah. That's awesome. Thanks for that. No, that's great. And going to the symptoms, because this is where everybody's like, so just because you go into menopause, do you start treating them, or do you only treat if they have symptoms, and do you even start investigating?
Not only the symptoms, but, you know, also the indications
for
when we end up getting talking about menopausal hormone therapy and non-hormonal therapy, we can talk about maybe.
Yeah. So it's always just as in any type of any branch of medicine is you've got to talk to the patient and really try to figure out, you know, is this menopause? Is this something else? So for example, if someone comes in and they're not sleeping well, but you also, they screen positive for sleep apnea, we wouldn't want to say, hey, that's menopause. We would want to say there could also be something else going on. It could also be both. And that's what, you know, is difficult about medicine in many ways, and also doesn't translate well to social media sound bites, right? So lots of people who have very large accounts love to simplify things in ways that they shouldn't be simplified. And yes, it could be. So for example, sleeping poorly is a symptom of the menopause transition. Often it's related to hot flashes or night sweats, but you know what? You could also have sleep apnea. You could also have depression. You could also have that as a side effect of a medication. It could also be related to life stress. So it's important to get a full history and sort of say, you know, which one is it? You know, the most reliable symptom of, you know, besides irregular bleeding is hot flashes and night sweats, right? And those are can be very uncomfortable for a lot of people. For other people, they're not bothersome at all. And some people don't get them. And so it's really important, again, to treat the whole person and say, you know, are these symptoms that are bothersome to you? And if they are, my gosh, we don't want you to suffer. We have therapy for that, right? If you're having bad sleep disturbance related to hot flashes, we absolutely want to treat that because we know that sleep disturbance is not good for you. And also you feel crappy when you're not sleeping well. So, but also, for example, if somebody had just started Zoloft and was getting, you know, terrible hot flashes at night and waking up with their bed soaked in sweat, we might want to say, you know, could it also be a medication? So it's important to always think about everything. And the further away from menopause somebody is, the more we need to investigate those symptoms, right? So if somebody's 38 and has regular periods and is having hot flashes, I'm looking for other causes, right? So versus if they're 50 and they haven't had a period in a year and they're having hot flashes, you know, I'm less likely to be deeply investigating other causes.
Or if so they're 65 and right. 65 and they haven't had a period in 15 years.
That's actually a great question because that happened. People definitely talk about that. They get hot flashes later. Like I never had hot flashes and now I'm having them and I'm 70 years old.
So I would be very worried about somebody who's 70 with new onset hot flashes. I wouldn't be blaming that on menopause. Now, there are, you know, people who have very long hot flash trajectories. So we have to distinguish between the person who had hot flashes at 50 and was ignored, right, and has now got a doctor listening to her at 70 versus someone who had no hot flashes at all and now is having them at age 70. I'm sorry, I'm looking for other causes because you didn't have a change in your hormone levels at age 70.
Yeah. So you're telling me we all need to practice holistic medicine despite what the quacks say and they hijack that term.
Right. Like, exactly. I mean, holistic is just whole person.
Yeah.
And people sort of, you guys both know, people talk about it like it's some kind of like, you know, witch or warlock, you know, with
mystical
herbs and poultices and, you know, I'm going to give you a spell as well as, you know, a supplement.
That's right. And yet it's exactly true. What they taught everybody in medical school and residency and fellowship. It's always holistic medicine. Anyways, I just wanted to point that out.
No, it's a great point.
So, okay. All right. So someone comes in with these complaints. How do you evaluate? Okay. We looked at their menstrual cycle and you went into some of these symptoms, let's say hot flashes, whatever. Okay, then what about other indications, contraindications to therapy? And then let's get into the therapies, I guess.
Yeah, so I kind of break it down for menopausal hormone therapy into green light, yellow light, and red light indications, meaning things that we have great evidence-based medicine to support, very low risk, that's green light, right? Yellow light might be, well, there's some data. It's kind of like on the fence or, you know, it hasn't really been studied, but it's biologically plausible, right? So this would be like the yellow light indications. And then the red light. So we've had that's been well studied. We don't have good data to support it, or the risks outweigh the benefits. And so I kind of divide it up into that. And so the green light indications are if you have hot flashes and night sweats, the gold standard is menopausal hormone therapy. However, we also have neurokinin 3 receptor antagonists, and we also have, that's a whole new class of drugs that's being explored. So there are non-hormonal therapies. There are some women who feel terrible when they take hormones. There are some women who can't take them because they have breast cancer or endometrial cancer, right? Or some specific kinds of ovarian cancer. So there are people who can't take hormones, people with, you know, cardiac disease, right? If somebody's 52 and they had an MI a year ago, I don't want to give that woman menopausal hormone therapy. So we have other treatment options, and especially the drugs, the neurokinin 3 drugs, like fezolinate, and then there's going to be probably another one approved soon. They're quite effective. And so we want to make sure that those aren't downplayed. And one really interesting phenomenon I see is, you know, there are people with very large social media accounts talking about menopause. And if it's not estrogen, they're basically shooting it down. And it's like, isn't it
estrogen
good that we
or GTFO?
More?
That's what they're estrogen or GTFO. Yeah. That should be the shirt.
That's their little thing.
And it's really interesting. So during the Super Bowl last year, the company that makes Fezolinate, or maybe it was 2 years ago. I think it was 2 years ago. I can't remember.
Well, it must have been last year because it got approved in like the spring of 23.
Yeah. So it would have been because it was before it got approved. They did a Super Bowl ad.
Super Bowl before.
Yeah. They did a Super Bowl ad basically talking to women about hot flashes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because obviously they're, you know, the first thing you do when you have a drug is you try to raise interest in the drug, right? And there were these so-called menopause champions talking about how awful and predatory that was. And I'm like, wait, what? Like, how is it predatory to have like another option? And I'm like, I don't want to carry water for big pharma, like at all, but it's how is it predatory to offer women fezolinate and not predatory to offer them estradiol? Like,
well, it depends on if you're making money from it or not.
Right. Well, because it fits their agenda.
Right. And because nobody positions non-hormonal therapy as the fountain of youth, and people position estrogen as the fountain of youth. Right. So hot flashes, night sweats, there's some pretty good evidence. So this would be like in the yellow light indication for using hormone therapy for depression in the menopause transition. It doesn't seem to work after menopause, but before. There's a little bit of controversy. And so, when you hear people sort of talk about the trials, you're like, oh, I can kind of see both sides. But it seems reasonable to try. And because it's a really low risk therapy, you try it for 3 or 4 months and you say better yes, better no, right? And then you have your outcome. It doesn't seem to work for cognition or brain fog, although admittedly it hasn't been studied in the menopause transition for that. But we have several randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trials looking at people in the early menopause, so within a few years after their last period, showing no benefit with cognition, right? And the problem with brain fog is it's like a vague symptom. Lots of people own brain fog, right? Like diabetes owns brain fog. ADHD owns brain fog. Depression owns
thyroid.
Brain fog.
Well,
I was
right,
say
thyroid, right?
Because this gets into where I come into play. I can tell
a lot
you.
Of overlap.
I'm just kind of my initial thing is that females don't often come into the endocrine office talking about menopausal hormone therapy. It's usually all these other things. And it turns out that they're often in their 40s. So I don't think they realize that they can be in their 40s with this. Mm-hmm. And then they think it's their thyroid, but it turns out they're not sleeping well because of hot flashes and all these things. And we end up doing female menopausal hormone therapy. And it's interesting that you talk about the data on the brain fog thing, because I tell you, people who don't feel well because of hot flashes and they're not sleeping well, what they call brain fog, I'm telling you, I know this is anecdotal, doesn't fit whatever the criteria were in the studies, but boy, they think it, they're better.
Sleeping better, everything gets better.
I mean, that's the thing. Talk about holistic.
I feel like medicine. Hell when I don't sleep.
Sleep, I always tell them, sleep is the unsung hero of all of our lifestyle stuff we push. And I just, I get a lot of referrals for looking into other hormone things, and it turns out they're just going through menopause and they're not sleeping well.
Yeah. And I think this is a really important point, because obviously if you're not sleeping well, if you have depression or all these factors, that can affect how you feel. And how I feel or how you feel is going to be different. We have different internal metrics for that. And so I try to think about brain fog as just brain fog, meaning there's no other symptoms going on, right? Versus I got brain fog and I got all these other things going on. And so I'm going to be treating all those other things. And if what you're calling brain fog goes away with treating all those other things, fantastic. But if you're saying you only have brain fog and that is the only thing that's going on, we don't have certainly data. It hasn't been studied in the menopause transition, but we have data that there's no improvement in cognition for people after. But is cognition a good surrogate for brain fog, right? We don't really know. Mm-hmm. And there's actually some data showing that changes in estrogen levels can affect executive function. And, you know, some people are exploring use for some of the ADHD medications for independent brain fog. And so it's just important that we not overly simplify this and sort of say, well, what, again, getting back to that holistic thing, like what else is going on in your life that, you know, that could be a part of that symptom complex.
That makes sense. Perfect.
Any other yellow lights indications?
Yeah. I mean, there is some data, for example, that shows a lower risk of diabetes for people who are on menopausal hormone therapy. The results aren't, like, the studies aren't that great. There's conflicting evidence. But I think if you had somebody who came in and said, look, like my mom, my sister, my cousin, my aunt, they all got diabetes at like 53. And, you know, I have glucose intolerance, you know, would it be wrong to sort of say to that person, might that be something that we could consider for you as part of, while we're also looking at everything else? You know, I don't know. I think that these are the longer conversations that you have with people in the office. That would be something that I would sort of talk with someone about from that standpoint. So I'd like the standard indications: hot flashes, night sweats, depression in the menopause transition. Oh, the other thing I wanted to say about brain fog, it's really curious. So when women report that they're having these cognitive changes, they perform far better on testing than they think they do, right? Hmm. So that's a really important thing. And so the only thing that's really come up in studies is basically some verbal recall issues, which is like word finding and that kind of thing. And there's even one study that shows that that women still outperform men. So I think what it's really important that we also think about the burden that many women are under in their 40s and their 50s. Yeah. Like if you have kids in school, and there's a lot of data that shows in heterosexual households that women do a greater burden of tasks that are unpleasant and draining. And so what else is going on that's affecting your reserve? Is it possible that you have all the things that you've been balancing for 15 years, like it's all coming home to roost. So okay.
Well,
it's
Rachel's
just
not allowed to listen to this one, Spencer.
Yeah. Nor is Jenna.
All right. Our wives aren't allowed to listen to this one.
No, please don't listen.
But it's so, and so
it's true. I think it's true.
Yeah,
it's true.
Of course it's true. That's why we,
it's true.
You know, but again, it's just important to sort of have these conversations. It's very easy to say, I'm going to give you a pill and make everything go away. Mm-hmm. It's also very easy if you have an expensive practice where you're charging, you know, $1,500 or $3,000 for a visit, that we know that the more people pay, the greater the placebo effect that they're going to get. The more the smoke and mirrors that go along with it, the better the placebo effect. And that's why women deserve studies and women deserve science. Yeah. And not
here we are making a podcast while our wives are gone working hard in the
Oh man. All right. Stop it, Spencer. Okay. Hey, well, here's another question for you, because from the endocrine perspective, of course, we studied a lot of, and learned a lot about the osteoporosis risk.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
So,
is she going to put that in the red light, or I want to hear what her red light's
on? Well, historically, this is why I want to set her up and see what she says. So, historically, the hormone therapy is approved for prevention of osteoporosis. And we, you know, going through fellowship and studying, we had a lot of good osteoporosis medicines by that point. And so, it's not really indicated, you know, for people who have osteoporosis. But it gets into the timing of everything and when people get screened for osteoporosis, if you're at high risk, if you're getting screened earlier, what do we call prevention, you know, all this stuff. And so we never, in the endocrine world, it never was really pushed much to do it just for that, because we do all the other things. But we certainly, I talk about it all the time, like if we have these other reasons, and they always come in for all sorts of other reasons, then I say, well, the good, you know, one of the known benefits is bone health. I mean, we talk about how you lose bone density immediately at menopause, and it's a significant thing, and we can prevent it. But yeah, where do you put that in the red, yellow?
Yes. So prevention of osteoporosis would absolutely be a green light indication, but like a lot of preventative therapies, not everybody needs it, right? And so that's why it's, again, really important to have this whole history and talk about it. So obviously, if you're taking it for hot flashes, well, you know, fine, and you've got that bone protection as well. So, you know, we can ask people questions to assess, as you guys well know, you know, risk of osteoporosis. So what's your family history? Are you a smoker? We can do a FRAX score or do an OST. But I think one thing that's often missed is talking with women about what their menstruation was like in their 20s and early 30s, because that's when you're building your bone bank. And so, you know, if I talk to someone and say, for example, you know, she tells me that, that she was suffering from anorexia between age 20 to 24, even though now she might have a normal FRAX score and she's 50, I'm like, or 51, I might say, well, you know what, maybe we should get a baseline bone density for you. Because while it is true that women do lose bone density during menopause and there is an accelerated loss, it's very small if you compare it to what's going on for building your bone bank, right? So if you go into menopause with that much lower bone bank, you are at far greater risk of tipping over into osteoporosis than someone who's going into menopause with this like massive bone bank, right? And some people lose more than others, related probably on genetics and lifestyle and other factors. And so, you know, there's a some recent guidelines that came actually from the International Menopause Foundation. Basically, if you have a bone density, you know, a T-score of minus 1.8, then the recommendation would be that, you know, considering a menopause hormone therapy for prevention of, you know, loss that could tip you over into osteoporosis during the menopause transition would be a good idea. And, you know, it's, you know, I see people who get bone densities and they have like stunning results. And I'm like, damn, that's fantastic. Wish that was me. I mean, I always like to be honest that that's why I'm on menopause hormone therapy. I had terrible hot flashes. And so it went on for that. But my mother died of osteoporosis and started getting fractures in her 50s. And the FRAX can't account for like that severity, right? And there's clearly something going on when you look at the number of fractures she had. And there's no way to figure out because she's dead and there's no testing that was done. We just know that she had terrible osteoporosis, multiple rib fractures, multiple vertebral fractures. She brushed her knee against a wall and broke her patella. Like there was something going on. And I have, right. There's clearly something, but you know, it was a different time and people didn't do things and, you know, she wouldn't listen to me because what would I know about women's health, right? So, but, you know, my bone density, you know, I have a, I'm like minus 1.6 and that's with, so that's, you know, but, but if you look at that with my family history, you know, that's something that's like, ooh, I'd be at a higher risk versus someone, you know, if my FRAX score was zero or my, you know, my T-score was zero, I'd be like, anyway, I'm not worried about it. Obviously, you know, there was some other factor. So it, that's why, again, it's holistic and you have to, you know, find out what's going on. And certainly osteoporosis prevention is one reason to take menopausal hormone therapy. And studies show that even very low doses are effective.
Yeah. So what are the red light red lights that you have? The
contraindications kind of?
Yeah.
I don't know if those contraindications are just what people say are reasons to take it that aren't reasons to take it. I don't know how you differentiate.
Yeah. So for me, like the red light is, so I would never prescribe menopausal hormone therapy to prevent dementia. The data does not support that at all. And so I think that, you know, it's an interesting area of research. But there's also, you know, data that shows, you know, MHC could be associated with an increased risk of dementia, maybe age related, maybe all these other things, but we are way too far from having any good evidence-based medicine in that area. And it's really important that people don't take studies that look at like estrogen receptors and what happens to that in the menopause transition and make some kind of leap from the basic science to what we should be treating with, which you guys know we see all the time.
Yeah, mechanistic.
That's what Huberman does.
We call it mechanistic masturbation.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
You know, or take rat studies or whatever. For example, with dementia in women, so women do have a higher risk of dementia. And while some of it is related to living longer, some of it isn't. But, you know, something like, I think it's 2 or 3% of your of cases of dementia or risk for dementia is related to lack of early education, right? And that's a major factor for women in many, many countries around the world. So until you have studies that can control for that, you can't, you know, you can't say it's one versus the other. And we just don't have that. But unfortunately, we see people scaring women that they're going to have dementia in 2 years after menopause if they don't start menopause hormone therapy. And that is absolutely not supported by any evidence.
That's terrible. What else? What other red lights?
Yeah. So another red light would be, you know, there is no recommendation to start menopausal hormone therapy for preventing cardiovascular disease. I think it's still there. there are some intriguing hypotheses there. I think we can say that for people who don't have cardiovascular disease, it's not going to increase your risk. So we can say that, and that's really good. But, you know, if we look at the studies, they're all over the place. There are different types of estrogen, different doses, different progestins. And so we have this whole mixed bag that we really can't say much from. And for example, you know, the standard hormone therapy that we recommend for all women is transdermal therapy, right? Although again, that we recommend transdermal over oral based primarily on observational data. So it's really important to be honest about that. But, you know, there is no randomized trial that I'm aware of that shows transdermal estrogen, you know, lowers the risk of cardiovascular disease. The ones that people often go to, like the Danish osteoprevention trial or, you know, these others, they use oral estrogen. So they're different drugs. You can't say that. So I think the harm there, you know, isn't that you're going to get cardiovascular disease from starting estrogen, but it's detracting you from the things that you can do to reduce your cardiovascular risk, right?
And this is where we've recently had to battle other physicians online who we thought were relatively reasonable at first, and then now they're like really selling this hard for some reason. They're selling.
Yeah, I don't know the reason.
And I understand the confusing data. And when I talk to people about risks and benefits, I say, well, if we start you earlier on, there may be this trend towards possible. I always say, just kind of say cardiometabolic because of the, like you mentioned, right, the diabetes, you know, maybe less weight gain, a little bit better proportion, maybe even the heart benefits depend, you know, and then I talk about the clotting and stroke with the transdermal. And I say altogether, hopefully you get some of this benefit too, but they are out there claiming and they're citing a quote from the AHA.
No, it's well, that, and there's a review paper. There's a review paper that goes over from the Journal of Cancer, by the way.
Oh, really?
That goes over mechanistic studies, the observational studies, and then basically subgroup analyses of the randomized trials that show a trend.
To say it's better than like our cardiovascular medication.
Better than statins.
We have absolute major adverse cardiovascular
huge amounts of data
dropping. You know what I mean? Like risk reduction.
Yeah.
Huge trials that are meant for this.
And they're different indications. They're complete. It's a false dichotomy. It doesn't even make any sense.
But how are they? I just can't believe they're getting away with saying this and pushing it like that.
Well, because nobody's pushing back.
Well, those same women are claiming that menopausal hormone therapy makes women into leaders too. That's one of the benefits of it, which is also, I would say, incredibly patriarchal, because you're saying, really?
That's what I was going to say, Spencer. I was about to say patriarchal. I'm glad she said it instead of me.
Yeah. Like my estrogen status has nothing to do with my ability to, you know, to do anything, you know, I don't want someone listening to say, well, I'm suffering from hot flashes and hormone therapy is helping me. Absolutely. Yeah, but this idea that being on estrogen is going to make you into a leader, that is like, that's just a perversion of what we saw in that book, Feminine Forever, from 1966. And, you know, it's really discouraging to see that and to see women, you know, I get attacked and the people who, you know, right, then, you know, I get, whenever I say, hey, we have to pause and be reasonable about this, which you would think that that's not something you get attacked for. Reliably, about 8 hours later, my Instagram is swarmed by people, you know, saying, you know, really just sometimes some pretty nasty things. I'm really like being the voice of reason saying women deserve science. That's, you know, like show me the randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trial of transdermal estrogen with and without a progesterone that shows that you're going to get that outcome that you're claiming. And if you don't have that data, you can't make those statements. I mean, there are people with accounts with 1 million, 2 million followers saying that menopausal hormone therapy is better than statins. And I want people hear. I mean, there's 27,000 women total in the randomized trials for statins, right? We don't have that data for estrogen. So if you don't have the same studies, you can't even begin to compare the two therapies.
Yeah. And again, it's a false dichotomy. Like this one's looking at lipids. The other one's looking at estrogen levels. And it's just like, you could use potentially both, but we just still have to study it. Like it could be adjunctive. I don't know.
You can't say things that aren't true. And they do it all the time. And that's the problem. That's how they get the millions of followers. Meanwhile, I'm sucking wind.
Well,
for example, like the Danish osteoporosis prevention study, it was an open label study, even though it was randomized, right? And it did show improvement in, you know, again, but you're studying women who were, you know, in their early 50s. So the number of events was low, right? Over 10 years. But they, it's an open label study. So the physicians and the patients, even though they were randomized, knew they were taking hormones. Is it possible that if you're on hormones, that that might, you know, make you do more exercise, that might make you think about your health differently? I don't know. But so this whole like being so definitive and so sure when the data is so all over the place is really concerning. But you know what? When you're on social media, as you guys know, that when your confidence is often mistaken as expertise.
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, that's 100%. Oh, yeah. You know, what's funny is that because that's one of the studies that this review paper went into. And what's funny, if you look at the Danish paper, you can then see there's a bunch of letters to the editor about like, this was underpowered, this was open. Like there's a lot of things. And so you just can't definitively say that you need a primary outcome that's adequately powered, meaning enough people and enough events, by the way. So again, if you have too few events, you won't be able to see a difference between the placebo and the drug.
Where, that's what scientific discourse is about. That's why we have letters to the editor for discussions, because studies are hard to do.
We're not discouraging hormone. We just use it for the indications. Don't make up stuff.
Right. And the thing about the Danish study, it was oral estrogen. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so you go. you cannot use that study to support transdermal estrogen. They have different effects on lipids. They can have different effects on the heart. They're different doses. And we know that, like, if we look at the KEEPS trial and the ELITE study, one had oral Premarin or transdermal estrogen, and that didn't show a benefit on CIMT. Mm-hmm. And the oral estradiol did. So is it the fact that the studies were underpowered? Is it that oral estradiol is really the thing that helps? Like, so we don't know. And again, that's a surrogate marker. It's not, you know, not exactly the outcome we're looking for. And I think what's really does women a massive disservice is that, you know, this kind of scientific discourse where we're like talking back and forth, just like you said about, you know, what about this study? What about that study? These are like hypothesis generating, and this leads to the next study and leads to the next study. And you need to be open. I'm totally open to whatever the studies show, but to be so definitive when we're like, yeah, but there's like all these issues, that's what's really concerning to me. Because when you look at like Swan or these other studies that follow women over time, something like only 7% are doing the recommended amount of exercise, right? Less than 20% are following the dietary modifications. And we do have studies. There was a 5-year study from Pittsburgh that shows that, you know, lifestyle interventions can blunt the rise in LDL that we see in menopause, right? So, you know, we're missing these really important conversations because it's like estrogen for all my friends.
Yeah. Is it Suzanne Summers' fault? Is that whose fault is this?
Well, I think that it's a lot of people's fault. You know, obviously, the halt in hormone therapy after the WHI was problematic. You know, what the WHI results were supposed to do was to stop people prescribing it for preventing heart disease. Because, I mean, I am pre-WHI. Like, I trained, I practiced before the WHI. And like, I had people telling me in residency that I should prescribe it to 80-year-olds for cardio prevention. Right.
Could you go into the WHI, like go into a little bit of the history, and then afterwards, I kind of want to get into like absolute contraindications, and then we'll go into the types of therapies we have, you know, if you have some time to talk about.
Yeah, but, sure. So, you know, in the 70s and 80s, there was, you know, mounting observational data that suggested that hormone therapy reduced the risk of cardiovascular disease, right? And the big problem with observational studies is who's more likely to get hormone therapy? Someone with health insurance, someone with money, right? Maybe someone who's taking better care of their health overall. So you don't know, is this an observation? Is this a true finding or is it spurious? And so this is when the Women's Health Initiative came out. And it was the largest randomized double-blinded placebo-controlled trial I think that's ever been done. And it had several arms. It had the hormone therapy arm, which was Premarin, which was the most common hormone prescribed at the time, and medroxyprogesterone acetate for people who have a uterus. And that's something we haven't discussed yet. But if you have a uterus, you must have a progestin or have a drug called basodoxifene to counteract estrogen, because estrogen will give you cancer of the uterus if you just take it. Like, it's just a matter of time.
It grows your uterine lining.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's known. So it compared those two. And then the other studies were like a low fat diet versus a regular diet for breast cancer, and then calcium for osteoporosis. So those are kind of like the three big arms. And it was halted early for the estrogen and the progestin arm, the permanent progestin arm, because of an increased in risk of cardiovascular disease outcomes. And it was, you know, clearly and breast cancer, and clearly not going to meet the goals of the study, right? And then the estrogen only arm was stopped a couple of years later, same reason, it was just not going to meet the cardiovascular disease outcome. And so instead of stopping people prescribing it to protect the heart, what happened was people just stopped prescribing it. And it's really hard, I think, for people who weren't practicing medicine at the time to kind of understand what happens when, you know, the media just talks about, you know, the risk of breast cancer and doesn't put that in perspective for treating hot flashes. You know, lots of medications have side effects. And if the benefit is worth it to you, then that's fine, as long as the risks aren't super high. And of course, there were like within days, there were, you know, lawyers going, were you on hormone therapy and have breast cancer? You know, and so, you know, what are people's, like, obviously it shouldn't have stopped people prescribing for symptoms, but media and propaganda, and it's very, very difficult for people to navigate. And it was pretty quickly people regrouped and said, no, you know what, actually it's fine for hot flashes. And yeah, there's a risk of breast cancer. And we think maybe it's related more to the progestin component, but we don't know for sure. And, you know, on and on and on. And so the study has been followed, and we have kind of now long-term follow-up. And, you know, the final analysis is, you know, yeah, it's, if you want to take this medication for symptoms and it's safe for you, that's great. That's fine. You should do that. You shouldn't suffer. But there isn't data from the Women's Health Initiative to support using menopausal hormone therapy for prevention of cardiovascular disease or reduction of risk of colon cancer or other things.
Yeah. Since you were kind of going through it, I mean, and that obviously happened a little bit before I was in med school, but I got to read about, I got to read about all the post hoc analyses. And so then we were very in tune to the timing hypothesis and splitting all those hairs and everything, but maybe better coming from your perspective, how did that play out then during that time? And what does that mean for everybody?
Yeah. So what happened was there was a lot of like, people stopped prescribing and women stopped taking it, even if their doctors were happy to prescribe. And so it was kind of this combination phenomenon. And what also happened, which is really sad, is we stopped talking about menopause because there really weren't other drugs that we had at the time. If you look at the timeline, the very first clinical trial looking at fluoxetine for hot flashes was just like a year or two before the WHI. And I think this first study for gabapentin and hot flashes came out around that time. So it was a different landscape, right? And so we didn't have anything else to offer. And this is where Suzanne Summers comes into play, right? So the WHI hits. We have, you know, all this, like, you know, the medicine is in a bit of a tizzy trying to sort it out. You know, there was a press conference. And so, you know, the first way a lot of us were hearing about it was from a press conference, not from reading the paper in JAMA, right? Which is a big difference. And, you know, it wasn't like it is now where everything was available online and you could get the study. Before that was even going to come out, you couldn't look at the preprint or anything. So playing catch-up's really hard, right? As opposed to having the data to go in when it comes out. So what happened was Suzanne Summers and Christiane Northrup, noted anti-Semite, just like to put that in there, who blames women for all of their health problems, you know, who was on Oprah something like 18 times, I don't know how many times she was on it, but, you know, so they, you know, they basically pushed this narrative that, you know, horse hormones were for horses, and that if you took estradiol, if you took bioidentical hormones, that they were completely safe. So of course there was no data to support this. But it sounded good, right? It sounded good. It's made naturally by your ovaries, except no one's giving you ground up ovaries. And again, just because it's from your body doesn't mean it's safe. I can take an extract of pure estradiol from human ovaries, and I can give you endometrial cancer with that. Right. So I can give you a stroke if I give you enough. So it's not that. So what bioidentical came to mean was hormones that are identical to what your body makes, which isn't exactly true, because while I can give you a pharmaceutical estradiol. It's still not exactly the same as what the ovary makes. It doesn't really matter. But if you're like a purist like me, it's irritating because if you make estradiol in a lab, you're making it from soybeans or from yams. So it's usually soybeans now. And you're taking a molecule like diosgenin, which isn't a hormone, and you're breaking it apart and turning it into estradiol. But if I make estradiol in my body, I'm making it from cholesterol, right? And so it all has one source in my body. My body gets cholesterol from lots of different ways. And if you're making it in the lab, you just have one. And so it doesn't really matter, but it's not truly bioidentical. So that's why it like irritates me. But the point of the matter is that it doesn't make it safe. I mean, I can give somebody thyroid hormone who doesn't need it. It can be bioidentical and I can harm them with that. Right? I can give you bioidentical epinephrine and harm you if you don't need it. So this idea that because it was the same molecular structure, biosimilar maybe is a better way to describe it, that it would be safe. And there wasn't data to support that. And for Suzanne Summers and her ilk, it wasn't just that it wasn't the pharmaceutical estradiol, it was this compounded estradiol and these compounded hormones. And she was a big promoter of the Wiley protocol, which was invented by someone who's not a doctor. It's just bizarre protocol where you're trying to give people hormone levels they had in their 20s. And that just took off. And because, you know, the issue is, so when I see someone in the office, I'm like, okay, here's the benefits that you could have from hormone therapy and here are the risks. And when people were doing this compounded hormones, they weren't talking about any of the risks. And because compounded hormones don't have to have the black box warning, they would seem to people like they're safer and they're custom, they're compounded. And so this is how this whole industry sort of took off. And in places where naturopaths are allowed to prescribe, they really got in on it. And it just became this whole thing. This led to then pellets and other types of therapies. And so we had this market where I think it's something like 30% of people are using these compounded hormones. Yeah. And they're not safer. And in fact, they're probably less safe because you may not be absorbing enough. So then you're not getting the health benefit for your bones, or you could be absorbing too much and you could have risk for endometrial cancer. And a lot of them end up using topical progesterone, which isn't absorbed through the skin, probably because it's so lipophilic, it just gets hung up in the skin and doesn't actually like get into the bloodstream. And so you could be at risk for endometrial cancer. And so you have this sort of predatory marketing, this, you know, illusion of being better. And this all sort of came from Suzanne Summers. And then she was on Oprah in 2009 with Christiane Northrup. And if you look at the Google Trends, which I've done, that's the peak for bioidentical hormones ever being searched.
Wow. I remember I was in med school at that time and hanging out with some doctors that were doing some of that stuff. So there are compounding pharmacies that I got information from. They have these huge packets of all these, you know, triast, biast, and all these different topicals. And I was like, what is all this?
And then, of course, right. Ironically, like you said, I mean, most of what we all prescribe is, you know, like, you know, maybe not truly, truly bioidentical, but in the terms of the clinic, I always tell the patients they are because, yeah, they're like the biosimilar type estradiols. Right. And then it's interesting. You were just kind of what you were talking to made me think kind of ironically how all those same kind of quacks always tell everyone they have to have natural thyroid hormone from pigs and
right.
cows and whatnot, rather than kind of our bioidentical or biosimilar synthetically made, you know, levothyroxine and liothyronine and stuff. And then they reverse the script for the,
I know.
As opposed to the horse, you know what I mean? But that's so amazing. And it doesn't necessarily, it kind of goes back to your point, like none of them are technically specifically bad per se, but we have to understand the, you know, what's been studied, how they've been studied, the risk benefits and all that stuff. It's just amazing. Just
well, yeah. If you compound it though, as she was saying, you don't know the pharmacodynamics kinetics.
That's a whole different thing. We're talking about are real, like, you know, regulated medicines.
Okay. Yeah, no. I hate using the word bioidentical in the office, but I'll use it because you have to use the language that people are exposed to. But I explain it to them and I'm just like, look, this doesn't mean it's safer or better for you at all. But what you need to learn is that we prescribe estradiol. And if the word is estradiol, it whether you get it from a compounding pharmacy or you get it from pharma, the raw hormone comes from exactly the same place. There isn't some bioidentical estrogen farm, you know, where they're growing yams that are picked by virgins that are, they're grinding them under the moonlight, right? Like it's packaging. And one is superior packaging that is proven to be safe and, you know, proven to absorb in the amounts that you want. And one is inferior packaging. And I always tell my patients, look, I'm taking estradiol to prevent osteoporosis. I need to know that I'm absorbing the right amount of the drug or it's useless to be on it. Yeah. And to your point, it's a really fascinating point about thyroid hormone because it's true. Really, so pig hormones are better, but horse hormones aren't. It's like, it's amazing. Fascinating. But, you know, I get really worked up about the thyroid stuff too, because one of my sons has congenital hypothyroidism and, you know, he's on, you know, L-thyroxine, and I don't want him to fall victim to some online predator that would make him think that, oh, he should be on some, you know, pig formulation. Although it's really funny because he's like, well, the first thing I do when I see health information is I look to see if they're an anti-vaxxer or not. And if they're an anti-vaxxer, then I just don't ignore them.
I'm like, it.
That's a great point for everyone listening.
It's an easy red flag. Don't listen to them.
Yeah. So, but that's a really interesting point. This is why all these cross, you know, specialty discussions are great.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So let's go into what are the reasons you should just don't go for the menopausal hormonal therapy, go for the non-hormonal therapy. Because if you're suffering from hot flashes and sleep disturbances from menopause and you like want this gold standard green light indication, what would be the contraindications, the reasons you should not take menopausal hormonal therapy?
So if you have breast cancer, we recommend not doing that. And that's what all of the guidelines still recommend. There may be some very unique situations where after in-depth discussion in the office, then that might be tried. So for example, you have somebody maybe 12 years out who's just suffering from hot flashes. And they've been menopausal since they were 32 or something like that, right? So, but for the bulk of the, for, you know, 99.9% of people, that's still the recommendation to not prescribe. For people who are at high risk for blood clots, there's a lot of nuance there because some people are at higher risk than others. Certainly if people have previously had a blood clot, then we tend to say no. But again, there can be some nuances because there are some people, you know, if you look at risk for blood clot, there is a spectrum, right? And some people have multiple factors and some people have one. But certainly we believe transdermal has the lowest risk and certainly the lower end is the lowest risk. But we'd be very, very cautious in that situation and probably not. Advanced liver disease, you know, would be another situation. And then somebody who's at high cardiovascular risk. And so, you know, the concern is that when people already, and you guys will be better able to explain this probably than me, but the concern is when there's established plaques, when there's a sort of established cardiovascular disease, that estrogen can actually be, you know, have a negative effect, right, on blood vessel stiffness, on stability of plaques and things like that. And so we use the ASCVD calculator, right, and sort of look at, you know, what your risk is. And if your risk is high, which, you know, most people use as 10% or greater, then we would not recommend a hormone therapy. And if you're between 5 and 10, we say, well, only transdermal and at the lower end. But if you've previously had a heart attack, for example, then, you know, be off the table. And so, you know, those are, you know, they're a smaller cohort, but, you know, there's a lot of women that are at high risk for cardiovascular disease that are not getting their cholesterol treated. They're, you know, they're not on statins. They're, you know, they have metabolic syndrome. They have, you know, all of these untreated risk factors. And so it's always a good time also to, you know, when we counsel people about hormones is to say, hey, we also want to look at these other risk factors and what can we do for your overall metabolic health.
Yeah, that's a great point. What if, you know, that's even in like the Endocrine Society guidelines. So my specialty's guidelines, there's a whole section on recommendations of regardless of the hormone therapy, this is a time to go over osteoporosis risk, bone risk, heart risk, diabetes risk, all the things, diet, exercise. There's a whole section on that.
Yeah. One thing we didn't talk about that is also a red light indication is we don't recommend giving hormone therapy for weight loss.
Yeah. Okay. Body composition. That's a big one. Right, people are talking about body composition right now. Yeah, they're saying because you start losing muscle, blah, 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 blah. You better start taking it.
And boy, the studies on it that sort of have the hypothesis generating, as you say, this sort of reassuring trend. I mean, yeah, there are studies that say, well, people don't gain as much weight, the ones who are on it. But again, no randomized controlled trials, and especially not for actually treating obesity. You know, anything, maybe a trend towards some potential maybe benefit, prevention benefit. That gets
there's
kind of
nutrient partitioning potential effects of visceral adiposity, whatever. But it's not major weight gain from the change.
It's not exactly. But going back to the sleep, if we fix their sleep and they eat better and all the things, the holistic approach, it can be a very helpful part of the overall plan. Absolutely. But not
it's not the indication. Itself. Right. Yeah. You're not using it for a body composition indication.
Right. But that's, you know, when you're talking about a 60-second reel, right, you're trying to get attention. And, you know, what are the things that get attention? Telling women that hormones solve everything. Absolutely gets attention. And I believe that's why people do it. When you look at the number of followers for people who are talking about hormone therapy, and there's kind of their overall kind of message, it's never when they're also saying, hey, you know, we also have bisphosphonates let's talk about bisphosphonates. Yeah. Today, let's talk about fizolinate. It's never that. It's always, you're going to die if you don't take menopause, you're going to drop dead. And this whole fear-based approach. And maybe that's not even what they're trying to do, but that's what a lot of women are taking away. And I think that's really important. And, when we get back to sort of what we were talking about earlier, when we look at the number of women who are actually, you know, doing the recommended physical exercise, I mean, there's a lot of room to do a lot of things. And absolutely. You know what, if you're sleeping poorly, getting that fixed might absolutely be the thing that helps you then go out for a walk the next day. Mm-hmm. So absolutely, looking at it from that holistic standpoint, I would absolutely say for that person, menopausal hormone therapy could be a really valuable part of your holistic approach to your life. Mm-hmm. But prescribing it for weight loss is not the same thing as part of that holistic discussion, right?
Yeah, I was told I was antagonizing just because I said we shouldn't be using it for cardiovascular disease prevention. And it's like, no, I'm just saying we should just use it for the indications and not just lie about it. And we don't have to make, you don't have to make up indications for it. Use it for what it's indicated and go with it.
Like, now, what about age from your perspective?
Yeah, I can say timing.
We do, but let's say, you know, a 65-year-old, so higher than the average age of the Women's Health Initiative, and this is where that timing hypothesis came from. Younger looked like there was more trend towards benefit. Older looked like that's where the risks was all driven. So where do you consider that in your, you know, in medicine for the people out there, we talk about absolute and relative contraindications and whatnot, and that could probably fit into that. But how do you approach it when an older person?
Yeah. So, I mean, definitely, you know, the data shows there's an increased risk of dementia with starting hormone therapy kind of age 65 and older. And so that's something people need to know about. I think that it's also important, so if somebody's age 65 or over, I'm going to be really hard pressed to start hormone therapy for that person. Like there's going to have to be a really mega, mega case. And I would be very, very hard pressed. I'd be like, you know, let's look at other things for your hot flashes. But say you get, you know, so normally we say, you know, over age 60, more than 10 years from menopause, that we shouldn't be starting it because of increased cardiovascular risk and increased risk of dementia. So what if you have somebody who's 62, whose last period was 55? So they're like 7 years from their last period. Well, again, that's where you would step back and say, let's look at things holistically. So what is your reason you want to be on it? Is it a green light reason? Okay, you're suffering from hot flashes. You've had them for, you know, they started a year or two after your periods, because sometimes that can happen. They can start late and you're suffering greatly. Okay, so you've got a green light indication. What's your underlying cardiovascular risk? So, you know, if you're 62 and you've got a ASCVD risk of like 6%, then maybe I'm going to say, maybe I should talk to my cardiology colleague or primary care colleague and say, should we get a cardiac calcium score? Should we get other things so we can understand where you might be in that cardiovascular risk? And so if you're 62 and you're like, everything is like just no risk, like you're like, you've got the healthiest blood vessel, you're the cleanest pipes, you're like, then for that person with informed consent, I would prescribe it. If you're 62 and I'm like, oh, you've got all these cardiac risk factors, there is a potential that this could be harmful for you. And so, you know, do you want to take, you know, one of these other agents that might be very effective for hot flashes, right? And so, you know, to think about it, those are more nuanced discussions than obviously, you know, we can have here. But, you know, I think that that's the approach that you have to take. Is this a green light indication? And what are your risks that we would be concerned about?
Yeah, that's...
It's good.
Same. Yeah, love it.
Okay. Yeah. Can we do a quick and dirty on the types of hormonal therapies and what's your preferred? Mine are similar to my brother's, but I want to hear your quick and dirty.
Yeah. So, you know, the recommended starting therapy is transdermal estrogen and oral progesterone with the belief that, you know, there's a lower risk of clotting associated with it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the reason. Although a lot of that's based on observational data, so it's really important that we mentioned that. And so, you know, if somebody's low risk for blood clots and they want to do oral, then, you know, I'm okay with that. So I think that, you know, think about that. The progesterone is less effective at protecting the uterus than progestins, right? So you also want to assess somebody's risk for endometrial cancer. So if you have somebody who comes in and, you know, they have a BMI of 40, they're already at a higher baseline risk of endometrial cancer. So that might be a patient where we either are very careful about monitoring their bleeding or have a discussion about would a progestin be better for them. And so again, those are kind of the nuances that you kind of get into. If we're talking about doses, if somebody's coming in for just standard hot flashes, night sweats, you know, usually I would recommend starting around a 50 microgram patch. That seems to be that's a moderate dose. It tends to be very effective in studies. And that would be where I'd go. If somebody's got primary ovarian insufficiency, or they're under the age of 45. And this is something we haven't talked about. We generally recommend hormone therapy for anybody under the age of 45 until at least the average age of menopause. So if you're 45 and older, then it's based on symptoms and other things. If you're under 45, we recommend starting for everybody. And so if you were 43 with premature menopause, then I'd probably go with 100 microgram patch because that sort of approximates the amount of estrogen that you get on average over a month from ovulation. And that's the dose that was studied for primary ovarian insufficiency in one of the good randomized trials. So that would be what I would recommend. And then as someone kind of ages, I would say, you know, if you're on 100, say you needed 100 microgram patch for symptoms at age 48, or say you were on that dose because that's the dose that's studied for depression in the menopause transition, kind of like in your early to mid 50s, I start saying, hey, can we sort of get you down to a 50 microgram patch equivalent? Because when we're looking at all of the data, they're not with these higher doses of estrogen for long term. So we also have to think about that, right? There are some people, I have people on like super high doses of estrogen. And I'm like, well, that's kind of getting close to birth control pill dose. And is that what we really want to do? So, you know, so that's kind of how I approach that. And, you know, but if you have somebody coming in who's like 54 with hot flashes or somebody who's been intolerant of hormones in the past, it wouldn't be wrong to start them on a 25 microgram patch and see what they, because you can always go up.
Yeah. That's actually what I do. I pretty much always, and I have the same exact spiel with patients. Like, this is kind of what reason we do this stuff. And I actually get more into, do you want weekly or twice weekly? And it could totally, just because I've had interesting feedback on that whole thing from patients. So I have that discussion with them. But I almost always start with the low dose, other than, of course, I do probably get more, you know, a fair amount of referrals for the premature ovarian failure,
right,
and have to go a little bit higher. I also think we need to talk about how long to stay on therapy, because I'm not so sure we know, and I'm not so sure we know what we don't know. And that's kind of how I end up talking to people about, you know, how long they're going to end up staying on it. Because you mentioned, you know, maybe de-escalating the dose. And so I know people are going to ask, well, do I stay on it forever? Do I stop it? And there's sections in the guidelines about that are very vague for a reason, because I don't think we know really.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, then something we haven't discussed is there is a risk of breast cancer associated with menopausal hormone therapy. And I think you can kind of break it down to about 1 per 1,000 per year. And so, and that's something that, you know, obviously then over time that, you know, that accrues. And so I think it's also important when you're counseling people about menopausal hormone therapy is to look at their risk of breast cancer. And the Endocrine Society guidelines mention this, and they're not as good about it in the Menopause Society guidelines. And so I do a breast cancer risk assessment on everybody before I start hormone therapy, you know, either, you know, the Gale model or the Tyra-Kuzik. Mm-hmm. And depending on if they've just, you know, if I've been able to give them the paperwork in advance or not. And that doesn't mean I'm not going to give somebody menopausal hormone therapy if they're high risk. But if they are in the risk category when we would recommend endocrine therapy for prevention of breast cancer, that's a different risk-benefit discussion. And so they're turning down that therapy for menopausal hormone therapy. And so I believe they should understand that it just as part of the risk assessment. Doesn't mean I'm not going to prescribe it. But the other thing is, because we know that oral Premarin is associated with a lower risk of breast cancer and a lower risk of breast cancer mortality, not when it's combined with a progestin, but oral progesterone or oral Premarin. If I have somebody who's at very high risk for, you know, higher risk for breast cancer, I'm going to be talking to that patient about Premarin and bezodoxifene. As maybe a preferred, you know, a preferred starting thing, because there is a really good review that was published in the Endocrine Society journal is, looking at risk of breast cancer related to underlying breast cancer risk for menopausal hormone therapy. And we use this like 1 in 1,000 for, you know, for the average person. But if your baseline risk is higher, that might be higher for you. And if your baseline risk is lower, that might be lower for you. So that's just all kind of part of the discussion.
What are the questions of breast cancer risk? Sorry to cut you off. Just like how, if somebody's listening to this going, I don't know if I'm high risk for breast cancer or low risk.
You can Google Gale model, the Gale model breast cancer risk, and you can put it in and it'll come out and it will spit it out and tell you if you're in kind of a high risk, moderate, or low risk category. And Tyra-Kuzik, I think that's how you say it, is another one. It's much more detailed, but it's also better. And that also helps us. Yeah. Well, because it gets, you know, when you have this more detail. So, you know, it gives you more information. And so also that might tell me, well, if you're at higher risk, then I need to be maybe pushing for you to get an MRI for screening your breast rather than just relying on a mammogram, right? So all of these other factors come into play. So from a long-term standpoint, we don't have long-term prospective data. There was an analysis of like Medicare data recently that made a big splash, but again, it's observational. The findings are actually pretty similar to the WHI, which is sort of interesting that yes, if you're taking an estrogen plus a progesterone or progestin, there's a breast cancer risk. If you're taking an estrogen alone, and that's the other thing, the breast cancer risk seems to be related to taking the estrogen plus the progestin or progesterone, not the estrogen alone. And so you just kind of have to look at that. So if somebody said, look, I had really bad hot flashes for 2 or 3 years, you know, I don't want to be on a medication long-term because I don't like taking medications and I want to try stopping it. Great. There might be also someone who says, I had the worst hot flashes ever and I don't ever want to risk them coming back. I feel so good on hormone therapy. I don't want to risk going off it. I say, okay, great. And I think that, you know, because we don't have data to say concerning, not concerning, you kind of have to look at what is the individual getting out of it? For some people, they don't like how they feel on hormones. Other people love how they feel on hormones. And, you know, separating what's true effect from placebo, we don't have that kind of data. And so I think that since we don't have data to say, apart from the long-term breast cancer risk, right? So that that tends to accumulate over time with use. That's really it. So some people say, that's okay. I mean, I can put that risk in perspective for me. The absolute risk for me is quite low. I'm okay with that. But everybody looks at risk differently, right? Like I once had somebody in the office who had a 50% risk of having, you know, a really bad outcome on not related to menopause. And she said, well, that means there's a 50% chance I don't. And you know, like from a
glass half full.
Right. And so most people be like, oh my God, like I need to take the therapy. I need to do this because 50%, oh my God. And so we all look at risk differently. And so I think it's important that we, you know, we look at that and say, in the in the absence of evidence that tells us we should stop it, if you think that you're getting benefit out of it and you've looked at this risk of breast cancer, and for you and for most people, it's a low risk. And certainly if you're on estrogen only because you don't have a uterus, then that risk may not even exist. There's some controversy about that. Again, it's all from observation. You know, Premarin, sure, no risk associated with that. So it just, you know, it depends on the individual risk.
What's the oldest patient you have on it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have people that certainly I'm refilling it in, you know, who are in their 60s. So, you know, I don't see a lot of people in long-term follow-up. I might end up starting people who had issues getting started elsewhere. And then once they're stable, you know, I send them back to their referring provider, because I have a specialty referral clinic. So if I kept every single person who I started on any therapy on, then my practice would have been closed, you know, years ago. So, but yeah, so getting people started. But I do have a lot of discussions with people who come in on pretty high doses in their 60s. And I'm like, you know, I think you should be open to reducing it, because, you know, all of the data that we have is based on, even though much of it's observational, it's based on lower doses than you're taking. So just something to think about.
Very good. Well, this is probably one of our longer podcasts. What is any closing remarks of what you'd want patients and even other doctors to know, like quick five bullets or whatever?
Well, one thing we didn't talk about was the oral contraceptive can also be a great way to handle the menopause transition. So just to keep that in mind, it doesn't have to be menopausal hormone therapy. After menopause, you know, we'd switch you. But so top five things, I would say that get the guidelines, the North American Menopause Society guidelines. The International Menopause Society has great information. The Australasian Menopause Society does as well. And they all match up. So get the guidelines and read them, because they have summary statements at the end of each section, that really I would think almost everybody could understand. So that you go into a meeting with a doctor prepared for what the science says. If your doctor is recommending something that's very different from that, then maybe it might be worth getting a second opinion. Because it could go in either way. You could have a doctor who says, oh, hormones are unsafe. Okay, well, that's not what the guidelines say, so get another opinion. You could have someone who says everybody should be on it for preventing dementia. That's not what the data says. Think about why you want to be on it. Like, write the list down and think about what are the symptoms that hormone therapy can help and what they might not be able to. And I would tell people to hold space for, if you're really suffering from hot flashes and night sweats, to get those treated first and then see what happens to the other symptoms on the list. Mm-hmm. Number three would be, don't ignore your metabolic health in other ways. You know, to think about, you know, hormone therapy is not a magic wand. It's one tool in a toolbox. And you want to think about your diet and exercise and all of those things. And be very careful about people who are leading with fear. That's, you know, it sells on social media and the algorithm favors fear, but be careful about that. And the last thing that I would say is that, I don't know what's the last thing I should say, is to always be suspicious when people are making this is the greatest thing in the world, this is going to treat everything. Just be mindful about that. And also, if someone's an anti-vaxxer, then block them.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. I would block them. Yeah, absolutely. You've been amazing. People can find you on social media, Jen Gunter. You're on Instagram, Twitter. Are you on TikTok? I don't know.
Yeah, I decided TikTok's not really, you know, not really for me. Yeah. And then we can continue, you know, the diet soda wars in your comments.
Yeah.
Dr. Gunter's been drinking a Diet Coke during our discussion, so we appreciate that. Yeah. She doesn't get, you don't get paid by Big Pharma, right? You don't get paid by Big Pharma or Big Soda.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's another thing people should be wary of. You know, you can look up your doctor to see if they've got pharma money, but you can't look up to see what kind of money they're getting from supplements.
Yeah.
And yeah, well, I recently looked at how much money you can make from designing your own line of supplements. I contacted, because, you know, these companies that will make them for you.
Yeah.
And if I designed a turmeric supplement and sold it for $35, I have to do an initial outlay of about $70,000 to do it. If I sell 8,333 bottles, I'm going to make $190,000 in profit.
Wow.
Look at that. So if anybody wants a good business idea, there you go.
So just, you know, just be wary.
Shilling turmeric.
Yeah. Be wary of add-ons. Like thermography is another huge red flag. Anybody recommending thermography. So just be wary about those kinds of things.
Very good.
Oh, you know what? One more thing.
Buy your book. Buy a book. Buy Dr. Jen's books.
But also, a lot of those people out there are trying to convince everyone they need to check their hormone levels. Which of course,
oh, yeah. We didn't talk about that.
Endocrinologist crazy because, I mean, my basic little spiel to people is that, you know, during the menopausal transition, the hormones are all over the place, so they're not helpful. And then afterwards, they're also not helpful because it's a clinical thing. Unless we really, you know, you don't have a uterus. We don't. There's some. So once in a while, and then we obviously have other reasons.
A lot of my patients just want to see the levels, and I'm always like, all right, if you're paying cash, fine, I guess. I don't know.
But it's so unhelpful. It can be really confusing to people.
It actually harms people because I see people who decide not to take therapy because they couldn't be in menopause based on their levels. Right. I'm like, I don't care what your levels are. You're 46 and you're having hot flashes and your periods are 45 days apart. Like, you don't need hormone levels.
Yep.
I think, and I always go back to that puberty analogy. Get your period at 2, you need hormone tests. Get your period at 13, not a surprise, right? And I just say to people that, you know, hormone tests are a really great way for a lot of people to give you the illusion of caring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The patients that ask me, they've been a year from, they just want to see their LH levels. Yeah.
Don't do it.
Yeah, no, I know. It's like, you don't need to do it. It's a clinical indication, but.
It can be to that point, it can be very hard to undo misinformation. And so sometimes you see somebody in the office and you're trying to build a relationship with that patient. Yeah. And if you say no, 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 no to everything, then they might leave you and then go somewhere else. So then you might say, well, what can I do kind of from a harm, like how can I look at this testing from a harm reduction standpoint? Mm-hmm. You know, because I know how to interpret an FSH. So I'm going to do that for a patient, for example, you know, because that's the way that I'm getting her.
Because that's the way that I'm getting her,
you know, to come into
evidence-based medicine.
What happened to something happened? All right.
My stupid microphone stuff.
What a way to end it.
Yeah. Well,
we need to end it then.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much. It was amazing.
Thank you for having
me.
I really appreciate it.
Here's our outro.
Okay.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.